porcelain dominoes. On the floor was the book Tales of Shakespeare, which Tatiana had mentioned she was reading to Alexei. He walked through the rooms occupied by Alexei's doctor and Alexandra's maid, the dining room in which the family ate their meals round a small carved oak table, the bathroom and water closet that all were forced to share. It was so cramped and uncomfortable, he couldn't bear to think of Tatiana living there. The guard posts were connected by wires with bells on them, bells that Tatiana had told him the family had been forced to ring when they wanted to visit the water closet. It was intolerable that a royal family's bodily functions had been so closely observed. The house had a horrible atmosphere that made the hairs on the back of his neck stand up. He hurried down the stairs to look around the ground floor where the guards had spent their time. No papers or telegrams gave any indication of the family's fate. Drawers were empty, the walls cleared of notices. He walked out into the courtyard and round to look for the door to the basement, but it was bolted shut. He rattled it, but it wouldn't budge. It was good to be in the fresh air again. Dmitri felt as though he were choking. Where were the Romanovs? Where was Tatiana? This house of special purpose was offering no clues. A few days later, Malevich arrived at the cottage and greeted Dmitri with a bear hug. "You look terrible, my friend. Have you not been sleeping?"
"Phew."
He wrinkled his nose. "I can tell you have not been bathing." True enough, Dmitri couldn't remember when he last washed.
"I don't know what to do with myself."
He shook his head.
"I've searched everywhere.
How can they have vanished into thin air?" "We will find them," Malevich promised. "I heard they might be on the other side of the Urals, perhaps in Perm. There is talk of a sealed train that left Yekaterinburg in the early hours of the 17th, and I'm willing to bet they were on it. The White Army is headed in that direction. Why not join us?"
Dmitri blinked hard.
"But what if Tatiana comes looking for me here? I can't risk missing her." "We will leave word of our plans with Sir Thomas. He will let you know if Tatiana returns to Yekaterinburg."
Malevich squeezed his shoulders.
"You are a great soldier, a brave man. The best thing you can do for the Romanovs is to free their country from the Bolshevik scourge and turn it back into the motherland we know and love."
He paused, then added, "You know it's what Tatiana would urge you to do.
What if the family are found while I'm stuck fighting somewhere?
When they are found, I expect you will grab the nearest horse and ride off in a cloud of dust, not stopping until you have reached them."
Dmitri nodded, his throat so tight it was impossible to speak. He would go with Malevich. It was better than doing nothing. Only by keeping busy could he hold at bay the terrible sense of doom that threatened to engulf him completely.
Chapter 34. Lake Akanabi, New York State, late September 2016. It was a blazing hot day, but Kitty shivered as she lay on the shore by her cabin reading about the murder of the Romanovs on the night of the 16th to the 17th of July, 1918. The account was based on a statement given by Yurovsky, the chief executioner, so was as close to the truth as would ever emerge. It was around 1:30 when Eugene Botkin, the family doctor, was wakened by Yurovsky. He said that the situation was unstable as the Czech army drew closer, and that the Romanovs should be wakened and told to come down to the basement for their own safety until they could be moved elsewhere. The family took 40 minutes to pull on their clothes, Nicholas and Alexei in soldiers' tunics, and Alexandra and the girls in white blouses and skirts. They were carrying small bags and seemed calm. Nicholas turned to the servants and remarked, "Well, it seems at last we are getting out of this place." When Alexandra asked about their possessions, Yurovsky assured her everything would be packed up and sent on. Kitty knew there had been a false alarm when they had thought they were being moved a couple of days earlier, so perhaps they weren't sure if this was another one. At 2:15 a.m., Yurovsky led the party of 10 down the darkened staircase to the ground floor, then out into the courtyard. Nicholas carried Alexei in his arms. Another door led down 23 steps to a basement, and they were ushered into a bare room with an unshaded light bulb hanging from the ceiling. Alexandra immediately asked for chairs. She could not stand for long because of her sciatica, and Alexei was too weak to stand at all. Two chairs were brought, and Yurovsky asked the girls and the servants to stand behind the Tsar and Tsarina, almost as if he were posing them for a photograph. He said a truck was coming to take them to safety, then left them alone while he went to check on the arrangements. They must have been sleepy, Kitty thought, after being roused from their beds. None of them seemed unduly alarmed. Did they whisper amongst themselves? Perhaps they speculated on where their next destination might be. Next door, the guards sat drinking vodka and nervously checking their weapons. The Fiat truck Yurovsky had ordered pulled into the courtyard, and after checking it at 2:45 a.m., he led his 8 co-conspirators into the room where the Romanovs waited. They were alarmed to see faces they did not recognize, but hearing the truck outside must have imagined their departure was imminent. Nicholas asked, "What are you going to do now?" Yurovsky produced a sheet of paper and began to read. "In view of the fact that your relatives in Europe continue their assault on Soviet Russia, the Presidium of the Regional Soviet, fulfilling the will of the revolution, has decreed that the former Tsar, Nicholas Romanov, guilty of countless bloody crimes against the people, should be shot." Kitty tried to imagine the terror and confusion in the room. No one could have expected that, even after all the months of captivity. What kind of nation would execute their monarch without a trial? Nicholas turned to look at his family. According to one report, he cried, "What? What?" before Yurovsky drew a pistol and shot him at point-blank range in the chest. He fell straight away, killed outright. The women crossed themselves as the guards began shooting, each at their designated target. A shot to Alexandra's head blew off part of her skull. Alexei remained rigid with shock in his chair, soaked in his father's blood, unable to try and save himself. His sisters fell to the floor, where they lay stunned and moaning in pain. The jewels they had sewn into their gowns deflected the bullets, so they were badly injured but not killed. Some tried to crawl away, but there was nowhere to hide in that bare room. The air filled with smoke, making it difficult to see, and the guards panicked. They began stabbing viciously with bayonets to finish off their victims, turning the scene into a bloodbath. Some of the girls were murmuring prayers, others screaming. Bullet after bullet was pumped into little Alexei. Tatiana was shot in the back of the head as she and Olga huddled in a corner, her brain tissue spattering Olga's face. Anastasia survived longer than the others and pleaded for her life, but was finished off by frenzied bayonet thrusts. It was an unrelenting, horrific way to die. Kitty thought of the last entry in Tatiana's diary. Although it was pessimistic, she could never have predicted such barbarity. The terror they must have experienced, the agony of the slash wounds. Kitty's hand shook, and she put down the book. She felt sticky, and could almost smell the choking fog of blood and gunpowder. Suddenly she rose and ran into the lake, wading out deep and diving beneath the surface. The water was refreshing, and she felt it easing a knot of headache in her temple. She turned to float on her back, under the white pulsating sun. Could Dmitri possibly have been there when the Romanovs were killed? If so, was there nothing he could do to stop them? She thought back through his novels, searching for clues to the nature of her great-grandfather. He was obviously articulate, very romantic, and prone to melancholy. She realized there was a theme running through the novels of a terrible wrong committed in the past, which overshadows his characters' lives. Could Dmitri have been haunted by a sin he committed? She desperately wanted her great-grandfather to have been a hero. But what if he was complicit in murder? It would be horrible to learn that her ancestor had been involved in this evil assassination of innocence. When she emerged from the water, Kitty twisted her hair into a ponytail and squeezed the water from it, then sat down and read about Yurovsky's bungled attempts to dispose of the bodies. Out in the remote countryside, When the guards stripped the family of their clothes, they found myriad priceless jewels stitched into their seams and linings. The Tsarina had rows of fine pearls in a belt around her waist. The corpses lay, blood-soaked, limbs askew, on the boggy ground. Yurovsky ordered his men to throw them down an old mine shaft, where he hoped they would be concealed. But it was soon apparent that it was too shallow. His men doused the bodies with vats of sulfuric acid, and the air filled with the smell of burning flesh. But Yurovsky had failed to realize that acid would not dissolve teeth and bones. In desperation, he threw a couple of hand grenades into the mine, hoping the shaft would collapse and cover the bodies. But they did not detonate properly in such an enclosed space. At last, he realized he would have to remove the family and bury them elsewhere, before suspicious local people came across the hideous scene. Kitty read that when the graves were eventually discovered in 1979, there was a jumble of bones and teeth all mixed up together, and it took researchers a long time to identify them. By then, there had been more than 6 decades of controversy about whether all the Romanovs had perished, a debate fueled by the fact that the evidence was contaminated by scientists who handled it over the years, and that Anastasia and Alexei were in separate graves some distance away. It was only in 2008 that DNA testing proved conclusively all 5 Romanov children, both their parents, and 3 household retainers had been massacred. Scientists took a DNA sample from Britain's Prince Philip, husband of the Queen, who was a close living relative of the Romanov family, for comparison. Kitty closed the book and stood up. She needed to drive into town before the stores closed, as she'd run out of wine. The quantity she was drinking had sneaked up during her stay until she was polishing off a bottle of rather pleasant Californian Chardonnay every evening. Chilled in the water beneath the jetty, it slipped down like lemonade after a long day in the sun. She never had a hangover, so reckoned her body could cope with that amount. Everyone knew those government guidelines were ridiculously cautious. In the supermarket, she decided to buy a case of wine, 12 bottles in all, to save her having to come back so often. "You having a party tonight?" the checkout girl asked, and Kitty smiled and said, "Yes, something like that." In the early hours of the morning, Kitty woke abruptly from a nightmare. All she could remember of it was the presence of something dark and evil in the house where she was trapped, possibly as a prisoner, although she never saw her jailers. She lay, heart beating hard, trying to adjust her eyes to the darkness, when suddenly she became aware of a faint movement in the far corner of the cabin. Terror gripped her. She pulled herself to a sitting position and groped for a box of matches. She couldn't hear any sounds now except the ones she was making, but it still felt as though something was in the room with her. The thought crossed her mind that it could be Dmitri's ghost. Then she shook herself. "Stupid girl. No such thing as ghosts." She struck a match, but her hand was shaking so badly she couldn't get the wick of the oil lamp to take the flame and had to strike a second one. A pool of flickering light spread round the room, and she looked into the corner where she had been convinced she heard a noise. Nothing but bare wood. She stood up, back to the wall, peering round and listening hard. She was covered in a film of sweat, her hand still shaking, so the lamplight shifted and swung. Suddenly, out of the corner of her eye, she saw something coming towards her. She screamed and almost dropped the lamp in panic, before realizing it was a large, white moth, drawn to the light. Its wings flapped and it smacked against the glass of the lamp. Instantly, Kitty realized that was the sound she had heard earlier in the darkness. It must have flown into a window. "You idiot," she whispered, still feeling shaken. She walked across the floor and opened the cabin door, placing the lamp on the porch so the moth would follow it out. The night air was cool, and she padded barefoot down to the water's edge, feeling the sweat evaporating on her skin. There was just a sliver of moon among hosts of faraway stars in an ink-black sky, and the water and trees were utterly still. An owl hooted, breaking the silence. Suddenly, there was a loud, distinctive rustling in the trees to one side of the cabin, and the terror returned. Kitty rushed to the end of the jetty, ready to dive into the lake if a wild animal ran out. What creatures might there be? Most likely it was a deer, she told herself. They wouldn't have bears or wolves by the lake. Or would they? She crouched on the end of the jetty, scanning the forest, alert for any further rustling sounds. The distance to her cabin door seemed huge. Something might pounce on her as she crossed the space. Her heart was racing. What if she were mauled to death by a wild animal out there miles from anywhere? It would be days before her body was found. She would die alone, in pain and terror. She hoped at least it would be quick, unlike the gruesome deaths of the Romanovs. A morbid mood descended as she crouched beneath the vast, twinkling sky. What difference would her death make? Tom would miss her, so would a few friends. But she had left no mark on the world. The Romanovs had their place in history. Dmitri left behind his novels and his descendants. But she had produced no children, hadn't achieved anything of note. She had never felt so insignificant as she did at that moment. Why had she not written a book yet? This summer by the lake would have been an ideal time, but she hadn't produced a single word. Writing was hard work, and while she could force herself to do it, when there was money on offer and a deadline to meet, she couldn't imagine how authors slaved for hundreds of hours without pay on the off chance they might one day get published. Perhaps she simply wasn't good enough. Maybe those with a genuine gift felt they had no choice but to write. But if she wasn't a writer, what was she? What talents did she have? She thought of her mother's wish that she should study law and shuddered. That would never have worked. She had chosen journalism because English was her best subject at school, not because of any burning desire to communicate the truth or any of those worthy reasons real journalists have. Perhaps she was simply lazy, as her mum had always said. Good for nothing. Useless. I suppose this is what they call a long dark night of the soul, she mused once her heart had stopped racing. There had been no further rustlings in the trees, so she hoped whatever creature had been there had moved on. She decided to make a run for the cabin, slam the door, and crawl back into bed. As she stood up, the wood of the jetty was smooth and even beneath her feet.
Chapter 35 Urals, Russia, September to December 1918. Every night as he lay in his bedding roll on the hard earth, Dmitri tortured himself with thoughts of the terror Tatiana must have felt when the cottage door was hacked down, the shouting, the rough handling she might have endured. He was still in shock about her disappearance. Malevich was convinced the family were being held in Bolshevik territory to the west of the mountains, and Dmitri prayed he was right, and that Tatiana was with them. But he felt sick to his stomach imagining alternative scenarios. During the day, the discipline of military life kept him occupied. They rose at a set hour, tended their horses, ate breakfast, then broke camp, before continuing across the Ural Mountains in pursuit of the Red Army. The terrain was steep and rough, and already there was a hint of winter in the air. If they did not get to the other side of the vast range before the first snowfall, they could be stranded for months with no food or shelter to speak of, so they rode from dawn until well beyond dusk. He did his duty in a daze, riding reconnaissance, poring over maps, giving orders to his men. But all the time the shocking disappearance of Tatiana hammered on his consciousness. One evening, a newcomer rode into camp, and Dmitri was astonished to see a familiar face from Tobolsk.
"Vasily Yakovlev! What on earth are you doing here?"
Yakovlev leapt from his horse and came over to greet Dmitri.
"I couldn't bear to watch what the Bolsheviks were doing to our people. The Red Army is a hornet's nest of suspicion and backstabbing. If I'd stayed, I would probably have been executed by now. So I switched to the side whose cause I believe in, and am fighting for the Whites."
Dmitri regarded him with suspicion. Their camp was no stranger to spies, and all had been warned to be wary about what information they passed on. Still, this man had once been a friend of sorts, and perhaps he had news of the Romanovs. Dmitri poured him a coffee and invited him to sit, introducing him to Malevich.
"Last time we met,
You were trying to save the royal family by diverting their train to Omsk. Whatever went wrong? He asked. Yakovlev shook his head sadly.
I did my best, but the railway workers took orders directly from Moscow, and the matter was out of my hands. I bitterly regret that I failed, especially since the rumour is that all have now been killed.
Dmitri's face blanched, and he sat very still.
What did you say? That I hear it wasn't just Nicholas who was shot in the Ipatiev house.
Yakovlev seemed surprised at Dmitri's shocked reaction.
I'm only repeating what I've heard, mind. I wasn't actually there.
Malevich joined in.
I have heard the same rumour, but cannot believe it. This government would lose the sympathy of all its supporters and would be condemned the world over. Perhaps Nicholas is dead. Even that is in doubt, given that they have not produced the body. But I'm confident we will discover the rest of the family as we march on Moscow.
Dmitri stood and excused himself from the group, stumbling into the woods at the edge of the camp. Once out of sight, he bent over and threw up violently, the bitter taste of bile scorching his throat. They can't be dead. They simply can't. If they were, he had failed utterly. He was directly responsible for the fate of the farm girl, Yelena. He had bungled all his attempts to rescue the family. It was possible their deaths were his fault, because the guards panicked when they realized that Tatiana had been freed. Malevich appeared behind him and flung an arm around his shoulders.
Don't listen to him. Stay strong.
Dmitri looked up in despair.
If I discover Tatiana is dead, I cannot go on living.
Malevich spoke sternly.
First of all, I simply don't believe the Bolsheviks would be so stupid as to kill them all. And even if they did kill those in the Ipatiev house, you have no proof Tatiana was there. I firmly believe she is out here somewhere, and she's waiting for you to find her. You owe it to her to carry on looking.
Dmitri turned and smashed his forehead against a tree.
I miss her so badly. I can't bear this agony.
He drew his head back to smash it again, and Malevich caught him by the shoulders.
You can and you will, he said firmly. Imagine she is watching you, and do as she would want you to do.
Dmitri felt the sense of his words, and they gave him the strength to pull himself together. One day, if he found Tatiana, she would ask what he was doing in this period, and he hoped to be able to say he behaved with courage. He vowed he would never give up searching until he found her, wherever she might be. At first, momentum in battle was with the White Army. With the help of arms supplied by the British government, and with a ragtag band of recruits from various different factions who were disenchanted with the Bolsheviks, Admiral Kolchak's men marched steadily towards Moscow. As they went, they liberated villages from Bolshevik control, freed prisoners, and overturned socialist reforms that had been imposed. White Army morale suffered a blow in November, when the British withdrew their support after signing an armistice with Germany. But the advance continued, and soon Kolchak's troops reached the River Volga, only 100 miles east of Moscow. By now, the snow lay deep and temperatures were dropping daily. All the men stopped washing because to expose bare skin in such cold would be a sure way of catching frostbite. They requisitioned food for men and horses from farms they passed. Dmitri felt ashamed to be depriving the occupants of their winter stores, but there was no alternative if they were to free the country from the lunatics who had taken charge. In December, Dmitri's division was dispatched further south to the strategically important town of Tsaritsyn, which the Red Army refused to abandon, and straight away there were fierce clashes. The Soviet 10th Army they faced had twice as many men, dozens of machine guns and artillery placements, but still, it seemed the White Army was creeping into the suburbs, winning over the town street by street. Dmitri took a few men with him on daily reconnaissance missions to check where the big guns were placed before each assault. They needed their wits about them in the hostile terrain, but his superlative training took over. He knew he was more capable than these Bolshevik opponents, who could spout socialist rhetoric but knew nothing of military tactics. It would not be long before they drove them back. On the 1st of January 1919, the White Army launched a major assault on Tsaritsyn. Within 2 weeks, they had advanced to form a semicircle around the city and looked set for victory. One afternoon, Dmitri's men were in a tall office building near the town centre, planning their next move, when suddenly shells began to rain down. He sprinted up to the roof, and peering through his binoculars, realized they were surrounded and vastly outnumbered by Red Army troops that had materialized seemingly out of nowhere. No other White Army groups were in sight. He ordered a small band of men to break free of the building and ride for help, but as he watched, they were shot down in the street like wild boar on a country shoot. While the officers were debating what to do, a shell smashed through a corner of the room, showering them in debris. As the dust settled, Dmitri saw that Malevich was trapped beneath the rubble. He was unconscious, his face white with plaster dust. Dmitri crouched to listen for sounds of breathing, but couldn't detect any. Working frantically, he heaved aside the debris, urging, "Malevich, wake up. Open your eyes. Breathe, man!" After lifting one massive block, he was confronted by a hideous sight. Malevich had been cut in half by the force of the blast, his upper body separated from his lower. His guts spilled out of the torso, while his mangled legs were facing the other way. Dmitri screamed in high pitch, and couldn't stop screaming. His entire body shook in revulsion. He turned away, unable to look at the slippery coils of intestine, the blank expression on his dearest friend's face. "No. God. Please. How can you do this? Why?" He should try to drag him clear and arrange a Christian burial, but the room was empty now. There was no one left to help. The sounds of shelling were further away, but the smell of blood and smoke still filled the air. Dmitri's ears rang, and he was shivering with shock as he paced up and down, up and down. Eventually, he decided the only thing he could do was to cover Malevich where he lay. He did that, murmuring a prayer for God to have mercy on his soul, since he had allowed his body to be so hideously butchered. When Dmitri finally went to look for his men, he realized the fighting had moved several blocks away. He ducked into doorways, making his way back towards the muster point where they had started that morning. No one was there. He headed towards the camp in the woods where they had slept the night before. Much of it was intact, the horses still tethered and bedding rolls abandoned on the ground, but there were no men in sight. He picked up his pack, which contained his most treasured possessions, Tatiana's diary and the waistcoat she had knitted for him. Dmitri found his horse, filled a canteen with water, then rode out to try and locate his troops, but wherever he went, he found piles of the dead. It had been a mass slaughter. He tried for several hours, but couldn't find anyone to report to, or any group of survivors numbering more than two or three. His unit seemed to have vanished into thin air. Somehow he found himself on the outskirts of town, riding through snowy conifer woods towards open country. "I should turn back," he thought. "This is desertion." But he did not. He galloped till nightfall, sustained only by sips of water from his canteen. When tiredness overwhelmed him, he took a room in a cheap inn, where he was tormented by bedbugs and traumatized by vivid dreams of his best friend's body ripped in two. Next morning, over breakfast, he saw the landlady reading a newspaper with a headline about the Romanovs, so he begged to be allowed to borrow it. The story read that Admiral Kolchak had commissioned a man named Sokolov, a local prosecutor in Yekaterinburg, to head an inquiry into the fate of the royal family, and it seemed he had found some burnt remains by a mine shaft outside Yekaterinburg. Fragments of clothing, a pair of old spectacles, and some jewels that had belonged to the family. Among the more grisly remains, there was a severed finger and the body of a small dog. Dmitri felt sick. The family would never have left one of their dogs behind if they could help it. Had it been poor Ortipo? And whose was the finger? The story continued with a fresh insistence from the Bolshevik government that although Nicholas had been executed, the family were safe. It said they were being accommodated in the town of Perm. Dmitri's heart leapt. He did not trust this government one iota, but why would they specify Perm if there was no truth in it? Tatiana's Aunt Ella had lived in Perm, so perhaps they were staying with her. Oh God, he hoped so. It was at least 1,000 miles to the north, too far to ride, but if he changed into peasant clothes, he could maybe take a train without raising suspicion. His mind made up, he went to inquire about train times. Chapter 36. Perm, Russia, Spring 1919. Travel was treacherous in a country in the midst of civil war, especially when you had recently deserted from your army. Dmitri kept himself to himself on the train and did not get drawn into any of the heated discussions amongst his fellow passengers, both for and against Bolshevism. Perm was in the hands of the White Army. It was unlikely anyone in this northern group would recognize him, but Dmitri kept a low profile all the same. He took lodgings under an assumed name, bought a horse, and began riding through the town, street by street, just as he had done in Verkhoturye. There were heavily guarded munitions factories, but he could find no private houses with guards outside. He began making discreet inquiries, asking if anyone had seen the Romanovs arrive, but was disheartened by the casual response. "They're all dead, my friend." No one seemed to care. From one cafe owner, he heard that Tatiana's Aunt Ella and her Uncle Michael, along with several other family members, had been executed by the Bolsheviks. But still he refused to believe they could have killed the young Grand Duke and the Duchesses. They were children. He kept busy during the day, and at night he drank himself unconscious to drown out the appalling dreams of Tatiana being dragged away by men with axes, and Malevich cut in half. By spring 1919, the tide in the Civil War had swung firmly against the White Army. Admiral Kolchak surrendered to the Bolsheviks in May 1919 and was promptly executed. The territories they had fought so hard for were recaptured. International help dried up, and the Red Army were once again advancing towards the Urals. When he had exhausted his search of Perm, Dmitri caught a train south just before the Red Army arrived in town. A young man travelling alone would arouse suspicion, and he did not want to find himself detained by a local Soviet, answering questions about where he hailed from. He intended at long last to visit his mother and sisters in Lozovatka, which was in Ukrainian hands, but on the way there he heard from a fellow passenger that Tatiana's grandmother, Maria Fyodorovna, and several other relatives were staying at the Livadia Palace in Crimea, so he decided to go there first. If Tatiana had managed to escape her captors, that's where she would head. She had always loved Livadia. It was midsummer, and the heat was fierce when he arrived at the Romanovs' luxurious white granite Livadia Palace to find it deserted, apart from a handful of servants. "Where is the Dowager Empress?" he asked a housemaid who answered the door. "They were rescued a few weeks ago by a ship sent by King George V of England. All were very relieved." "Were any of Tsar Nicholas's children with them?" He held his breath. "No, we've heard nothing of them. There are rumours that they've been killed, but Maria Fyodorovna refuses to believe it. She said no one could be so heartless." "You look faint, sir. Would you like to sit down a while?" It was another bitter disappointment for Dmitri. Somewhere in the vastness of the great Russian hinterland was his wife, the woman he loved above all others on earth. But he no longer had any idea where to look for her, or even if she was alive. She could be waiting for him, despairing of him finding her, and he felt useless and impotent that he had no idea where to look. Dmitri sent a telegram to his mother saying that he would visit within the month. Then he spent another week wandering around the Livadia estate, hoping against hope that Tatiana might arrive. The staff accepted him when he explained that he had been a member of the royal escort, and produced meals and refreshments as if he were an honoured guest. He tried to imagine Tatiana strolling by the fountains in the Arabian courtyard, playing croquet on the manicured lawn with a view out to sea, swimming in the clear blue waters, dining on the open-air terrace, bathing in the white marble bathrooms. It made him feel a connection with her. This was a place she had loved, and he could see why. But it also made him contrast the rarefied lifestyle she had led with the realities of life for the country's peasants, something he had seen at first hand over the previous year. In Livadia, luxury was taken for granted. The paintings in lavish gilt frames, the heavy hallmarked silver cutlery, the ornate carved furniture. Everything smelled expensive. The average peasant eked out the barest existence on a diet of root vegetables and rough bread, with few possessions beyond the clothes they wore on their backs. It was an inequality that should be righted, but he loathed the methods of the Bolsheviks. Towards the end of the week, just as he was planning to leave, he received a telegram from a neighbour of his mother's. "Regret your mother died in April, stop. She heard you were killed at Tsaritsyn, stop. Your sisters have sailed for Constantinople, stop." There followed an address in Turkey. A howl burst from Dmitri's lungs.
"No!"
He ran through the park to the edge of the sea, howling all the way. The sound seemed to echo around the bay, and two gulls took off from a ledge in the cliff. Dmitri fell to his knees, his forehead to the ground, and tore at his hair. If only he had contacted his mother as soon as he left Tsaritsyn. He should have gone to visit straight after his father died. He had let her down, just as he had let Tatiana down. It was as if God had turned on him, and everything he touched turned to dust. He was a failure as a husband, and a failure as a son. He did not deserve to live any more. The waves lapped against the shore with a steady rhythm, giving him an idea. He would swim out to sea, and keep swimming further and further, until his strength left him, and he slipped beneath the waves. That way, at last, he would bring his torment to an end. He stripped off his shirt, boots, and trousers, and stepped into the water. His body would never be found in the vastness of the Black Sea. His sisters would continue to think he had died at Tsaritsyn, and that's what Tatiana would hear if she tried to search for him. That thought stopped him. What if his body washed up on the shore? He could not bear to have Tatiana think of him as a coward. He sat down on the shingle, sobbing hard. No. His punishment was that he must live with the shame of his actions. He would be tortured by guilt for the rest of his life, but at least he could try to make it up to his sisters, and possibly, one day, to Tatiana. Dmitri stayed in Crimea to fight in the White Army's last futile battles against the Bolsheviks, under the command of General Wrangel. In early 1920, he got on board one of the last ships taking refugees south to Constantinople, and made his way to his sister's house. They were astounded to see him, and there were long days in which they told each other all that had happened in the years since they last saw each other. He wept as he told them of Tatiana. He cried more when Valerina told them of their father's death in Bolshevik custody. They suspected, but could not prove he had been executed.
"Mother never fully recovered," Valerina explained. "Her heart grew weaker, and she could not exert herself without risking collapse. When we got the news that you were killed in battle, it was almost as if she gave up on life."
"I blame myself," Dmitri began.
"Don't ever say that,"
Valerina interrupted, taking his hand and squeezing it tightly.
"From what you have told me, everything you did has been for love. I don't believe God will frown on that."
He shook his head. "How can I live with the wrong I have done?" Valerina had the answer.
"You will get out of bed every morning and keep going, hour by hour, day by day, and gradually it will get easier. Vera's husband will give you work in his carpet business, and you can live with us. You should write to all of Tatiana's relatives, wherever they may be found, and if she escapes from the Bolsheviks, she will know where to find you. But in the meantime, you must grit your teeth and carry on living, because to do otherwise would be hideously cruel to your sisters, who love you and have only just found you again."
He lifted her hand to his lips and kissed it tenderly.
"I'll try,"
he whispered, the words catching in his throat.
Chapter 37. Lake Akanabi, New York State, end of September 2016. A few days after her terrifying nocturnal experience, Kitty was planting some flowers in a patch alongside the cabin when she heard a car crawling down the track. As it got close, she recognized Jeff from the vacation park, along with an older man.
"Morning, Kitty," Jeff called. "How you doing?"
"I'm hot,"
she called back, embarrassed by the dark patches of sweat on her t-shirt. As the men got out of the car, she saw that Jeff was carrying a FedEx parcel the size of a pillow.
"This is my granddad," he said of the older man, who tipped his straw hat in greeting. "I'm giving him a ride home and thought I'd stop by with this." He handed the parcel over. Kitty clutched it, surprised. "Goodness, what is it?" The address on the label said it came from Marion, her cleaner in London. The bag was open at the top, and she glanced in to see her long, chunky olive-green cardigan, a useful cold-weather cover-up. "Thanks for bringing it over." "My granddad wanted to see what you've done with the cabin. Hope you don't mind." "No, of course not. Feel free to have a wander." The old man was looking round the yard.
"What are you planning?"
he asked. "Purple cone flowers, hydrangeas, and some black-eyed Susan," she told him. She'd asked advice at the Indian Lake Garden Center about what plants were likely to survive the winter. He nodded in approval.
"Last time I was out here must have been when we found your great-granddaddy's body,"
the old man commented. Kitty was startled. "He died here."
"Yeah. I came out to look for him after the storekeeper told me she hadn't seen him for a couple of weeks. Found him lying frozen solid on the ground, and his dog got in the body. Half-starved that dog was. A lovely creature. I took him in myself."
He smiled.
"Kids loved him."
"So you knew Dimitri. What was he like?"
"Well, we never got much beyond saying howdy and commenting on the weather. After he died, we tried our damnedest to find some relatives, but without success. So the wife and I went to his funeral to pay our respects."
"He had a daughter, Marta, who was my grandmother, and a son, Nicholas, as well. I wonder why you couldn't find them. Had they been estranged?" The more Kitty found out about Dimitri, the more she realized how little she knew.
"I guess they lost touch along the way. Course, that was in the days before the internet. You can pretty much find anyone now."
After Jeff and his granddad left, Kitty went into the cabin to open the package. As well as the long cardigan, there was her fleecy dressing gown, the one she wore to cuddle up in front of the telly on winter nights. A bundle of post that had come through for her, a new novel by one of her favourite authors, and a family bar of Galaxy chocolate. Had Marion packed all this for her? She opened the chocolate and munched a square as she flicked through the mail. A postcard from a friend in Costa Rica, a bank statement for her personal account, a couple of invoices, some complimentary play tickets, and a letter with a note from Marion on the outside. "Hi, Kitty. I couldn't lie when Tom asked if I knew where your cabin was. I refused to give him the address, but promised to send this package and let you know he's missing you terribly. We had a long chat the other day, and I feel sorry for him. He's a decent man." Kitty was irritated. People always thought Tom was decent. That meant, if there was any change to the normal harmony, it was automatically assumed to be her fault. "Anyway, I'm sorry to stick my nose in where it's not wanted, but I couldn't see the harm in you having this lot, and the enclosed letter from Tom. Hope you're okay out there. Marion." The envelope wasn't sealed. Kitty glanced inside and recognized Tom's handwriting. Nerves twisted in her stomach at the thought of reading it, and she decided she would wait till later, when she'd had a glass of wine for Dutch courage. She went back out to the garden to continue her planting, wondering exactly where Dimitri was found dead. It felt kind of creepy that he had died there. Later that evening, with a bottle of Chardonnay by her side, Kitty sat on the jetty with Tom's letter in one hand. The sunset was magnificent, all salmon pink and mauve, and for a while, she just watched. As the light faded, it felt as though she was looking through a sepia filter that was darkening minute by minute. She fetched her gas lamp, poured a second glass, then began to read. "Hey, Kitty. The weather has turned to autumn here, with rainy days and chilly evenings, and I worried you might get cold out there, in the Adirondacks. It's hard to tell from your wardrobe, but it looks as though you've only taken summer clothes. If you want me to ship out anything else, just ask. If you've been reading my emails, and I hope you have, you'll know that I've been seeing a counsellor for 6 weeks now." Kitty's eyes widened with surprise. Tom had never struck her as the therapy type. Wonders would never cease. She took a big gulp of wine before reading on.
I never thought I'd do something like this, but it's a fascinating process that is helping me to understand why I did such a stupid, destructive thing as to have sex with Karen Bayliss. It only happened 4 times, and it was over long before you found the messages. But that's obviously 4 times too many. There are no excuses, of course. But I was feeling pretty low when I didn't get that promotion at work, and I got the feeling, rightly or wrongly, that you were disappointed in me. Kitty frowned. She couldn't remember which promotion he meant. I know you're not interested in my job, and I think I've basically sold out to the establishment, but moving departments would have meant a more creative role. I'd like to be involved in something to do with music, even if I'm never going to be Bruce Springsteen. Anyway, I've registered with an agency to try and find another job, and have a few interviews coming up. So my dented ego was one reason for the stupid infidelity. It's embarrassing how neatly I fit the midlife crisis criteria. Approaching 40, a few pounds overweight, frustrated at work, and feeling lonely because you and I stopped communicating at some point. And I miss being close to you. I won't bore you with the therapeutic term for this kind of phenomenon. I'm just disgusted with myself for being a cliché, and most of all, for hurting you. The person who means most to me in the world. Kitty shivered, although it was a balmy evening, and refilled her glass. Tom was obviously taking the whole counselling thing very seriously, studying it as if for one of his accountancy exams. My counsellor thinks I subconsciously left my phone where you would find it that day. She would like to have a session with us together, but I explained that you were on the other side of the Atlantic and not replying to emails. Frankly, I would rather you slapped me, yelled at me, and smashed up my laptop, than disappeared for weeks on end without any communication. It's excruciating to be on the receiving end of the deep freeze treatment, and not know when I might see you again. It seems a long time since we talked, properly talked, about anything. I've been trying to work out how long, and I think it started after your parents died. We'd only been married a year, and I expected you to be sobbing yourself to sleep every night, breaking down during the day, drinking too much and eating too little. Instead, what did you do? You bought that big run-down house in Tottenham and spent every waking hour doing it up, rebuilding, redecorating, fitting a new kitchen, tiling the bathrooms, more or less single-handed. Your energy was scary, but you never once mentioned your mum and dad, and if I spoke about them, you left the room. Since then, it has felt to me as if I'm not allowed to bring up sensitive subjects. And after a while, I stopped trying. And now we find ourselves estranged. Kitty remembered that period. The house she was doing up had dry rot everywhere. Wiring that was centuries out of date and dodgy plumbing. But she had welcomed the distraction. She freely admitted that she dealt with her parents' death by keeping busy. She thought back to the policewoman coming to the door with the news of the pile-up on a Spanish motorway. She'd felt numb during the flight out to Malaga. Tom had to identify the bodies, because she simply couldn't do it. It was as if she was anaesthetized for the first few weeks, and could hardly feel anything. But when she did start to feel, the pain was intolerable. It could have destroyed her. And so she had bought that house in Tottenham, with so many problems that really it would have been easier to demolish it and rebuild from scratch. What was wrong with distracting yourself from grief? She'd got through it. That was the main thing. Suddenly, Kitty's elbow caught the bottle of wine, and it toppled and fell into the lake. She swigged the dregs from her glass, then got up to fetch another bottle from the cabin, before reading the rest of the letter. Don't think I'm trying to put any of the blame for the infidelity onto you. I'm a messed-up piece of shit, and I hate myself for what I've done. Please know that I will do anything it takes to make it up to you and turn our marriage back into the beautiful, loving, fun partnership it used to be. Tell me what you want and I'll do it. I simply can't be happy without you, Kitty. I hope you are having a lovely summer out there. Contact me when you are ready to talk, and I'll either fly out to you or we can meet in a place of your choice and see where we stand. Just don't ever doubt how much I love you. And how much I regret what I have done. Your Tom. Kiss, kiss, kiss. It was pitch dark now, and there were bats gliding overhead, while frogs croaked a nighttime symphony. Kitty drank another glass of wine, and suddenly she began to cry. What am I crying for? She wondered, and had no answer. But the compulsion had taken hold. She grasped the letter and hugged it tightly to her chest, as she wept like a child, with complete abandon. There was a painful spot deep inside, and she hoped the crying Jag might shift it, but when she clambered up to the cabin and pulled herself into bed, fully clothed, it was still there.
Chapter 38 Istanbul, 1922. Dmitri dragged himself through the next 2 years, morose and self-hating, often seeking release from the thoughts and images that tortured him in the bottom of an arak bottle. His time with Tatiana seemed a distant dream, a fairy tale from a past life in which he could distantly recall he had once been happy. He found it hard to be around his sister, Vera, with her two adorable children and attentive husband, because it reminded him of what might have been. Instead, he spent his evenings with Valerina, a clever, creative woman, who had never found a husband, but who occupied her time painting charming pictures of the Turkish landscape. One morning in March 1922, Valerina came rushing to his office to show him a story, just a few paragraphs long, on the inside of the front page of her newspaper. "A woman in a Berlin asylum is claiming to be Grand Duchess Anastasia," she cried. Dmitri grabbed the paper. There was no photograph and no details about where she had been since 1918, but he was elated. "If it is Anastasia, then she might know where the others are, where Tatiana is. And surely if Tatiana is alive and reads the same story, she will travel to Berlin to be reunited with her sister." It said in the newspaper that the woman in question had lost her memory, but Dmitri was sure he could prompt her to regain it. He had spoken to Anastasia several times in St. Petersburg, and she would certainly know him. For the first time in years, there was positive news, and he allowed himself to become excited, although it was tinged with anxiety, because there was always a chance that Anastasia could be the bearer of bad tidings. He resigned from the carpet business, apologizing to Vera's husband, packed a small brown leather suitcase, and bought a ticket on the Orient Express to Munich, then another ticket to travel onwards to Berlin. On board, he willed the train to go faster. He couldn't wait to see Anastasia, couldn't wait to hear what she might have to say. It felt odd arriving in a country whose soldiers he had been attempting to kill just 6 years earlier. He spoke only a few words of German, and had difficulty making himself understood when he asked directions to the Dalldorf Asylum, mentioned in the news story. It was a wide, three-story sandstone building, with ivy climbing up the front, set in neat, extensive gardens. He walked up to the front door, knocked, and addressed the matronly woman who answered in English. "Might I see Grand Duchess Anastasia? I am an old friend of the family, from Russia." The woman replied in German, and he could only catch the word Anastasia, but from her gestures, she appeared to be asking him to leave. He tried speaking to her in French, but got the same reaction. "I must see Anastasia," he repeated, looking up the stone staircase beyond, wondering where she might be. He could easily rush past this woman, but wouldn't know where to go next. A doctor came by who spoke some French, and he explained to Dmitri, "Our former patient, who was known as Anna Tchaikovsky, has moved out of the asylum and is living with a Russian émigré by the name of Baron von Kleist." Dmitri asked if he had the address, but the doctor said it would be unprofessional of him to give it, although he added, "I suggest you ask around." "But where would I ask?" The doctor wrinkled his forehead. "Try the cafes of Charlottenburg, where there are more Russians than Germans. Good luck, my friend." Everything was a struggle in this foreign land. Trams trundled past on electrified lines, but none of them had the name Charlottenburg on the front, and when Dmitri asked for directions, he found few who understood him. Eventually, one woman directed him onto a bright yellow tram and told him to ask for Prager Platz. Night was beginning to fall when the conductor called out that they had reached Prager Platz, and Dmitri descended into a bustling square with a grassy area in the center. All around, brightly colored electric signs were being illuminated outside cafes and restaurants. Everyone seemed to be in a hurry. He chose the busiest cafe, called the Prager Dealer, and immediately heard a group of men conversing in loud Russian.
"Excuse me," he interrupted, "but do any of you know where Baron von Kleist lives?"
Another one looking for Anastasia. A man in a purple cravat rolled his eyes at his companions, then turned to Dmitri. They won't let you see her. The Baron is fiercely protective. But I have a friend who spoke with her while she was in the asylum, and he swears it is not her. She doesn't even speak Russian, for God's sake. Dmitri's spirits plummeted. She doesn't. He had pinned too much hope on this meeting, full of optimism that he might soon find his wife. What a fool he was.
Come, have a glass with us. My name is Boris.
The man poured a generous measure of ruby wine into a glass and handed it to Dmitri.
You've just arrived in Berlin, I suppose.
Dmitri nodded his head and accepted the wine, feeling devastated. The men scraped their chairs closer together to make room for him.
All the same, he continued, I'd like to see her for myself. I knew Anastasia in St. Petersburg when I...
Boris held up a hand to stop him.
The first rule here is that you must be careful not to identify yourself as a monarchist. Keep your counsel. There are many Bolshevik spies in town, and you can never tell who you are speaking to, especially after a few glasses of good burgundy.
Thank you. I appreciate your advice. Dmitri introduced himself and learned the names of the other four at the table, all of them Russian. He could tell from their accents that two were from the St. Petersburg area, one from Moscow, two from Siberia, but he did not ask their backgrounds. They refilled his glass, and when the bottle was empty, Dmitri bought the next one. At around midnight, when Dmitri's words were slurred and his head spinning, Boris took him to a nearby apartment block and introduced him to the landlady, who fortunately had a small apartment available. Before he left, Boris pushed a piece of paper into his hand.
"The address you wanted," he whispered. "But don't get your hopes up."
Next morning, after Dmitri had held his head under a cold tap to clear a thumping headache, then eaten a filling breakfast of sausage and sauerkraut in a cafe, he set off to find Baron von Kleist's apartment. Boris's note said it was on the fourth floor at number 9 Nettelbeckstrasse, which he found with the help of a street map borrowed from his landlady. He rang the bell, and when it was answered by a black-suited butler, he asked,
"I wonder if I might see Anna Tchaikovsky. Tell her it is Cornet Malama."
His stomach was twisting with nerves. Was he about to learn the truth about what happened to Tatiana?
"I'm sorry, sir. She is unwell and not seeing anyone."
"If I write a note, will you give it to her?"
he asked, and the butler agreed with a slight shrug. Dmitri scribbled a message then and there, saying he was delighted to hear Anastasia was alive, and wondering if she had any news of the others. He said he would be happy to perform any services she might require of him, and signed it Malama.
"I'll wait in the park across the road in case she changes her mind about seeing me," he explained.
He paced up and down, checking his pocket watch, looking up at the windows of the Baron's apartment. Would she glance out to see if it was him? An hour later, when there had been no word, he rang the bell at number 9 once more.
"Did she read my note?" he asked.
"As I said, I'm afraid she will not see anybody,"
the butler repeated, expressionless. Dmitri felt shattered. He had come so far and invested so much hope in this encounter that it was unbearable to have hit an impasse. There was nothing more he could do, so he stopped in a cafe down the street to ease his disappointment with a tumbler of vodka. Chapter 39 Berlin, 1922 Dmitri spent long hours in the cafe near Baron von Kleist's residence, watching the door in case the woman who claimed to be Anastasia might emerge, but there was no sign of her. One morning, as he waited, he found a copy of a Russian newspaper called Rul, Rudder, lying abandoned on a table, and flicked through it. Produced in Berlin, it reported on matters of interest to the city's Russian community. From just a cursory read, Dmitri realized there were many factions. There were the pro-monarchists, the Bolsheviks, and the constitutional democrats, who thought Russia should enter into the modern age with free elections. The whites accused the Bolsheviks of being Jews seeking global domination, and argued about the best way to wrest Russia from their control, while spies from the Cheka, the secret police, infiltrated their number and assassinations were not uncommon. He could see why Boris had recommended that he keep his counsel.
Dmitri had saved some money while working in Constantinople, but he would need to earn more to keep himself